Or so soon. So last time I was out here, I spoke about my work on dark matter halos. And so today, I thought I would tell you, I thought I would tell you about some previous work that I had done with Olivier Doré, Dragan Hooterer, and Alex Shirikov on a surprising effect that non-Gaussianity can have on large-scale structure at late times. Okay, so here is the outline of what I'll be saying today. So I'll first start off by describing some of the reasons why people have been interested and excited in primordial non-Gaussianity recently. I'll spend most of the talk describing a surprising effect, produced in large-scale structure by non-Gaussianity. And then towards the end of the talk, I'll describe some of the current and future constraints on non-Gaussianity that can be derived using this effect. Okay. And of course, Okay, so let me first just start off, though, by motivating some of the reasons why I was interested in non-Gaussianity in the first place. Okay. And so the main reason is shown here. Okay, so here I'm showing a gallery of gravitational lenses that my collaborators and I have found over the past few years. So these are all massive clusters of galaxies. Okay, so hopefully most of you know what galaxies and clusters are. If not, please tell me. No, I was told that there's a lot of it's a diverse audience.
The
yellow objects in these images, those correspond to member galaxies within these clusters. But these funny-looking blue distorted shapes, those show higher redshift background galaxies, whose appearance has been gravitationally magnified and distorted due to lensing by these foreground massive clusters. Okay. All right. Now, this has all been part of a survey that I've been doing with some collaborators. Please.
So why are they blue?
So in the rest frame, this blue light, would have come out, more blue. So say purple or something, UV or something. Right. But the observed light that we see here is always peaked towards the blue. Does that answer your question, or do you need something more?
So it was originally more blue.
The light we're seeing in this band originally was more blue,
yeah.
And it's being redshifted due to the expansion of the universe.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, hopefully I didn't flub that completely. Okay, go.
But I guess if I could just flash on that,
please.
The center stuff are yellow.
So intrinsically, the spectra for these galaxies tend to be redder than these galaxies. These galaxies tend to be star-forming galaxies. They're full of young stars. Young stars tend to be blue. These galaxies tend to be older. There's not much star formation going on in these cluster galaxies. Okay, yeah, in populations, therefore, the stars tend to be redder, which is why they look, like yellow and reddish in these images compared to these blue galaxies, despite being at a lower redshift. Good. Yeah, so please ask more questions throughout. I think I might not have enough slides, actually. So, okay, good. Yeah, so this has all been part of a survey that we've been doing. There's a slide missing. Sorry, one second. I'm not sure how that happened. Okay, sorry about that. All right, so this has all been part of a survey that we've been doing to find clusters like this on the sky. We've so far found about 200 examples of massive clusters like this that are strong lenses. And let me show you our best example, which is here. The slide somehow disappeared. Okay, so this is RCS 2327. This is a redshift 0.7 cluster that we found, which happens to be the largest known lens on the sky. Okay, so its lensing size, as you can see, is about one arc minute. Okay, so this size is, it's about one arc minute, which is about like 10 times bigger than the sizes of most of the lenses that you see, you know, for clusters. We've measured masses for this cluster using several different methods, so including, lensing, X-ray temperature profiles in Ivanovich, velocity dispersion in the member galaxies in the clusters. And these masses all come out consistent with each other and also enormous. So the mass of this object seems to be around a few times 10 to the 15 solar masses. Now for z equals 0 today, that sort of mass would be like very, very large. But at redshift 7, that sort of mass is just completely insane. It's so insane. It's so crazy. It's so crazy that for our currently favored cosmology, the likelihood for us to have seen something this massive at such a high redshift, given our survey area, is about 10 to the minus 4, somewhat less than that. So all of you should be like gasping with horror right now. But I guess you're all jaded like me.
It's just that I'm ignorant. So why is what you said is we shouldn't see a cluster this big.
This big at such a high redshift given our small survey area.
Right. So
we know how to predict the expected number of objects like this on the sky as a function of mass, as a function of redshift. And so for our currently favored cosmology, the expected number is like 10 to the minus 4.
Why does it get less likely with increasing redshift?
Yeah, that happens because structure is growing as a function of time.
Okay.
Anything else?
So, 14 billion years is tight for the ancient universe.
Oh, sorry, what?
13.7 billion years is a tight age of the universe.
That's measured very well by WMAP. That's right, yeah, that's right. At the age of the universe, I think, is measured extremely precisely. It just turns out that way.
The way in which the likelihood was computed is it's fully nonlinear and all that. What approximations have you made in computing the probability?
Yes, very good. So what we've done is to take fitting functions to the mass function, the halo mass function, and we computed the integral of the mass function from this mass and higher, from that redshift and higher. And that number is, that number is about.
So this is pretty. It's converged on fitting functions.
That's an excellent question. I would say the answer is no. I would say that this number is not well known theoretically. Most people, however, would say that the opposite. It is well known.
So explain why you.
So this mass corresponds roughly to about a 6 or 7 sigma fluctuation. Simulations have measured the mass function out to around like 4, maybe 5 sigma. So we're extrapolating very far.
I'm struggling to see 6 or 7 sigma. That would be a much time more probability than 10
No, actually, it turns out, so the number of halos as a function of sigma does scale like e to the minus mu squared over 2.
Yeah.
But there are prefactors that also depend upon mu. And those prefactors boost the number enormously. So the Preschecter mass function would have predicted a much lower abundance because Preschecter ignores all these prefactors. Right.
Surprising it can boost you from e to the minus 4. I'm surprised the prefactor can really make that generation. You said 6 or 7 sigma, that's e to the minus 36.
And the number of samples of this mass inside of our universe is also a very large number, right?
Oh, I thought you said it's not quite a small region.
Well, so the survey is covering about 700 square degrees, so it's about like a couple percent of the sky. Well, it's just about a small fraction of the sky. Well, so as we see later on in the talk, so much more is coming soon, right? We're now 4 pi stradians pretty soon, I think, or maybe even more.
In the standard cosmology.
Ah, no, this is beyond the standard cosmology. Okay, right. Okay. Okay, yeah, so it seems like we have a problem here. Okay, yeah. Okay, so then, right. Is there any way for us to save our cosmology? Okay, and of course, no surprise, you know, the answer possibly could be something like primordial non-Gaussianity. Okay, so now I'll talk about non-Gaussianity for a little bit. Okay, so non-Gaussianity has, of course, been a very hot topic over the past few years. There's been a lot of work, much of it here at Perimeter, on the subject. There's been lots of work showing how non-Gaussianity can be used as a probe of physics back in the very early universe. So, okay. So the context here, of course, is the physics of the early universe, right? So the standard picture in modern cosmology is that back at very early times, some process like inflation lays down small density perturbations. Those perturbations then grow over time through gravitational instability, eventually developing into all of the large-scale structure that we see around us today. Okay, so all of the galaxies and planets and things that we see around us today, they were all seeded back at very early times by some process like inflation or something else. Okay, I guess this audience is pretty inflation heavy, so maybe I don't need to go through the slides that I have about inflation. So it's all hopefully just standard for you guys. So inflation, of course, corresponds to a time back in the very early universe when the expansion of the universe became exponentially fast, when the universe was dominated by some component whose pressure was negative enough. Inflation solves many, many problems for us, as you guys, I think, have heard millions of times. There are lots of ways to produce inflation. The simplest sort of best known example, I guess, is a simple example of a scalar field slowly rolling. Slowly rolling to give you enough e-folds. Okay, and as you all know, inflation can also explain the perturbations away from a perfectly homogeneous universe that we've seen around us today as our scale structure. And the simplest models always produce fluctuations that are nearly Gaussian and whose spectrum is close to a perfectly scale invariance just because the potential has to be so flat. Yeah.
So since I don't know any about being about all this I'm just your token idiot over here.
If you want, I can go through this more slowly. I assume that people like Sarah would be bored out of their mind.
Well, to not bore them, the one thing I'm wondering about is slow roll. Could you maybe give 30 seconds on what the heck that means? Because I've heard it a lot, and I have no idea what it means.
Right, okay, so I'm probably not the best person to ask for this. So my definition of slow roll just means, just means that this term is small compared to this term. Okay. So for a scalar field, an energy density is given by the sum of the kinetic term and the potential term, ignoring spatial gradients. The pressure, though, it turns out, is given by the difference. Okay. So for inflation, we want to have P about equal to minus rho, which means having this term very small compared to this term. Okay. There's also a second condition. You can derive, I think, on curvature of the of this potential. But the way that I've written it here, I think, just sort of translates into a condition on the slope of the potential. And the experts, I think, can correct me. This is not my area.
Ridiculous.
That's
the inertial term is irrelevant in the equation of motion.
Yeah. Well, so your friction dominated here, right? Because the Hubble expansion rate is so high. Anything else? Okay. Where was my perturbations? Yes. Okay. Right. Okay. So we don't observe these perturbations immediately following inflation. Okay. We instead observe them several hundred thousand years later through observations of the temperature and anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background. And our observations of the CME temperature and anisotropies largely confirm all these predictions made by inflation. Okay. So for example, the spectrum of density perturbations required to fit the CMB power spectrum has to be very close to scale invariant, as expected. The distribution of the CMB temperature perturbations is also seen to be very close to Gaussian, as expected. Okay. So overall, inflation is doing very well as you...
With some slight anomaly.
I'm not going to talk about that. Inflation is perfect.
Okay.
good. <No. laughs> That was easier than expected. okay. So even though inflation, so even though inflation normally predicts very close to Gaussian perturbations, it does predict generically some small amount of non-Gaussianity. And it's not hard to see why, again, using the simple example of a slowly rolling single scalar field. Okay. Right, okay, so we saw before, we saw before that the amplitude of the perturbations laid down during inflation scales with the Hubble expansion rate during inflation, okay? And the Hubble rate is, of course, just determined by the energy density at that time. Okay, so consider what happens when some long wavelength background mode exits the horizon, okay? The perturbation imprinted on that mode, perturbs the energy density inside the horizon, by an amount proportional to the perturbation in the field value times the slope of the potential. This perturbs the Hubble expansion rate. And then changing H, of course, therefore changes the RMS perturbations on small scales. Is that a fair statement? Okay. Okay, good. Yeah. So increasing the background energy density, increases the RMS perturbation. Decreasing it lowers the RMS perturbations. And so therefore, you can see that we have a non-zero correlation between long wavelength perturbations and the variance of perturbations on small scales. Okay, so we have a non-zero three-point function, which of course is non-Gaussianity. Okay, good. And the strength of this non-Gaussianity is of course controlled by the slope of this potential, right? Okay, now for slow roll inflation, of course, the slope has to be very, very small, and so therefore normally, we expect the amount of non-Gaussianity to be very, very small for normal kind of slow roll single field inflation. Try and stay awake, Nyash. Okay, but you can easily get larger amounts of Gaussianity using more complicated models. One well-known example is the curviton scenario. The details aren't really so important here. Okay, just the upshot is that for sort of sensible models with sensible parameter choices, it is possible to get large amounts of non-Gaussianity. Okay, all right. So as you can see, the possible range of non-Gaussianity produced back in the early universe can be, very large. Okay, and so And so for these sort of reasons, you can use non-Gaussianity, therefore, as a probe of physics of the early universe. Okay, so for example, any detection of a large local non-Gaussianity would just immediately kill all of these single field inflationary models, which would be like pretty amazing, right? Okay, right.
So you might have known this all along, but the peons like us, we're stumbling in the dark. Strong upper bounds in FNL could also detect or rule out possible alternative models to inflation. Okay. All right.
Also models without inflation.
No.
We even have them here.
All right, well, so. All
right. Sorry. Okay, okay, so for these sort of reasons, there's been a huge amount of interest in trying to detect or constrain the amount of non-Gaussianity. Yeah, go ahead.
Can I ask again a nice question? A nice thing about models that you would rule out single field inflation is that single field has one field and one parameter, basically, which is the self-interaction. And it's possible to imagine, and the slope roll parameter is related to that parameter, and everything is very tight. If you have to go to an inflationary model with a number of fields, you now have a lot more freedom. You have a lot of coupling constants. So what's the methodology to try to relate the theory to observation?
So try to disentangle like the various parameter freedoms from the data. Yeah, I have no idea. Maybe you should.
But you're getting more information, right? You shouldn't be doing a correlation function. You're getting a lot more information, so you can put each order of perturbation theory in each coupling constant with correlation function. So
how
many new things do you
want?
Are you willing to put in?
No. That's the right kind of.
Yeah.
So as long as there are more new things to measure than there are more new parameters, you have a whole book.
That will never be true.
Shane,
I'm sorry, I raised it.
Shane Ockham gets some shit.
Yeah. Saint or Pope or whatever.
Saint Ockham is wrong.
Okay, good. Right. So the current constraints for measurements of the CMB three-point function already are very strong. Okay, so WMAP has already constrained FNL within the range of minus 10 to about 70 or so. And in the near future, Planck is forecasted to do much, much better than this. So Planck is eventually forecasted to reach FNL of, FNL down near 5 or so. It will eventually be limited by secondary anisotropies, like, for example, lensing of the CMB. Okay, so can we do better than this? All right. So now I'll describe one alternative method for probing Lagrangianity using observations of R-scale structure at late times. How am I doing on time? Okay, so this is how R-scale structure evolves. Okay. So we start off at early times with small perturbations that we see in the CMB. Those perturbations then grow over time through gravitational instability, eventually developing into all this beautiful cosmic web structure that we've all seen many, many times. Okay. Right. Okay. And so then the program then will be to try to constrain non-Gaussianity using its effects on the sort of cosmic web structure. Okay. And so to illustrate the idea, here I'm showing you different simulations as a function of the amount of non-Gaussianity, okay? And it may seem as if, nothing much changes. Yeah, and that is true. Yeah, not much is changing. But as we'll see in a few moments, though, certain objects, rare objects, can be dramatically affected by having non-Gaussianity. Okay. All right. So the program, again, then, will be to try to measure the cosmic web, right? Okay. Now, we can't directly observe the matter density fluctuations themselves directly, at least typically. Okay. We instead have to observe tracers of the matter density field. Okay. And those tracers can be things like, say, galaxies or quasars or clusters. And the relationship between the tracers and the matter field can be quite complicated in principle. But fortunately for us, so fortunately it turns out that basically all the tracers of interest, like galaxies or quasars or clusters, they all form inside of objects that we call dark matter halos. Okay, so what are halos? Halos are structures, that are collapsed in all three dimensions, x, y, z. That are gravitationally self-bound, and that are virialized in some kind of vague sense. Okay, more practically speaking, perhaps, halos just correspond to these blobs that we've all seen in n-body simulations. Okay. All right. Now, from these kind of movies, but probably seems as if halo formation is a very complicated process that's impossible to understand. But it turns out, though, that there is a simple way to understand halo formation just using linear perturbation theory. Okay? And so the key point is that halos, especially massive halos, start off life as peaks of the initial random density field laid down during inflation. Okay?
So the idea is you know, well, it's shown here schematically, right? Okay. So this halo starts off life, you know, at some peak of this random field. Okay, you know. And so the idea is that the time when the halo forms, okay, you know, that time coincides with the time when first order perturbation theory would have predicted that the linearly evolved height of this peak has grown to some threshold value called delta C. Okay? And so instead of doing the full horrible nonlinear calculation, okay, So instead of doing that, we're instead just using first order perturbation theory applied to the initial random field, like an after inflation. Okay. Now this model may sound just completely crazy, okay, but it's not, okay, as I can show you. Okay. So here is a comparison between the predictions of this very simple peaks model with the results of full n-body simulations. Okay, so the black curve here shows the prediction of this very, very simple peaks calculation. And the points with error bars show the number of halos that you find, the number of halos that you find in a full cosmological n-body simulation. Okay, this is the ratio. Okay. And so you can see here, that the model works very well describing the full, the full n-body simulations.
So I want to see if I understand what you, the model that you described on the previous slide. So if I understand correctly, you start with this sort of, uniform noise, and linear evolution
with some power spectrum.
Right, it's got some power spectrum.
Yeah, that's right.
And linear evolution of that would kind of just, be random walking. It would continue to look like noise if it was always linear evolution. Is that right?
The statistics of that noise would, of course, evolve over time.
Sure, it would change to different noise, but it would keep having the same curved spectrum.
Right.
But nonlinear evolution gives you these collapsed halos.
Right.
And what you're saying is a good model of this is
if
you just let it fluctuate.
Of that noise.
Right. So you let it fluctuate until the noise produces a peak.
Sorry about that.
You let it fluctuate until the noise produces a peak that's greater than some critical density, and then that part collapses.
And then, yeah, you have to make a halo.
Okay.
In a sense, that's the model. Okay, good. Okay, so you can see the simple peaks model works very well at describing the number of halos that we find in these simulations. Okay, we're actually even doing a better job than the standard fitting functions. Okay, that are commonly used in the astronomy community.
So let me ask you that. Does 10 to the minus 4 come from this?
10 to the minus 4.
The one that came.
Oh no! Sorry. Yeah. No. So that number came from using these fitting functions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But now you can use your thing that's
yes.
Better than the tuning function. Right?
Yes, it worsens the problem.
It worsens.
Yeah. So my hope originally was that doing all this would fix everything, but it actually makes things a little bit worse. I mean, not much, like a factor of two, but yeah.
When you say it's better than the fitting functions, how do you verify this? What allows you to claim that it's better?
Yeah. Okay. Right. Well, so here I'm plotting the ratio between our model and the results of the n-body simulations. The colored curves are the fitting functions. Okay. I can also show you different regimes for which the fitting functions disagree, with the n-body results by factors of 10.
So why did these guys use these fitting functions?
Yeah. Well, it's easy, right? Well, actually, this is being recorded.
So this is compared to numerical simulations. Your
points with error bars are that's right. Yeah,
right.
Full n-body simulations.
They did simulations too. Simple.
Yes, but nowadays people only simulate cosmologies that are very close to our standard WMAP cosmology. Okay.
So they somehow infer these fitting functions from some other simulations.
Yeah, so most of these, that's right. Right, so the Warren simulations, I think, were calibrated to a WMAP-like cosmology. Sheth-Tormann was, I think, the GIF simulations. I believe, I've forgotten what Jenkins used, but yeah, right, yeah, there are all sorts of cosmologies similar to our standard cosmology. Yeah, okay, right, yeah. If you try doing cosmologies with, say, you know, or like different power spectrum shapes, it completely breaks down.
These models are based on collisionless matter.
I'm assuming, yeah, perfect CD. That's
how do you put in variables? Because variables are important for galaxies. Yeah.
Yes, that's
non-linear.
So here I'm only making a comparison between dissipationless NMI simulations and the simple model. One wants to compare it to things like actual galaxies. You are perfectly correct that the baryon physics has to be put in. We currently don't know how to do that in any, you know, in any controlled way.
So there are well known problems with n-body simulations of galaxies. Cusps, artificial law.
There, yes, yeah, that's right. There's lots of possible, yeah, right. There's lots of possible problems for this model on small scales. Yes. Yeah.
Is it is it conceivable that the baryons pancaking would enhance the Graf peaks?
No, I don't think so, right? You know, so the baryons have a temperature compared to the dark matter, which is perfectly cold, right? So I believe you expect the dark matter to like deform cosets and cusps before the baryons do, right? You know, the baryons can be dragged in. Into the into the dark matter potentials,
I'm just thinking in terms of
that process often heats up the baryons even more. Right?
So the cosmic web is comprised of sheets which intersect on lines, and then there are special points where multiple sheets intersect.
That is one way of thinking about the cosmic web.
Yeah. So now the baryons are naturally collapsed onto these sheets by the dark matter. But the difference is the baryons are dissipational, and so they. Their concentration builds up more, obviously, than the size of the galaxy. So
in very high density regions, that's correct. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But in sheets and filaments, though, you know, the densities reached there are let's say, like, in delta of, like, a few or 10, which is not enough, I think, to cool the baryon significantly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But inside of collapsed structures like halos, that's absolutely correct. And so simulations that include cooling often have problems matching observed baryonic properties in galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
There's various problems in this field, like overcooling.
But that's unlikely to be an issue with this giant object.
So on, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, any more questions? Yeah.
So the thing labeled with our model is the peak threshold model?
Yes.
And the rest are fits to n-body simulations?
Yeah, that's right. So these fits are things like, like polynomials times like random functions, and they have like lots of parameters in them, and they'll just like tune dramatically for the simulations. Yeah. James, you had a question?
Same question. So you're using the initial phases and the initial conditions to find these things.
No. Okay. All I'm doing here is taking the abundance of peaks for Gaussian random fields known from BBKS.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. That in combination with a simple model for collapse. Tomorrow, I guess, I'll be talking about that in more detail. Okay, good. Got it. All right, so now that we know how halos behave in normal cosmologies, let's see what changes when we have non-Gaussianity. Okay, so I'll be focusing on the so-called local class of non-Gaussian models, for which we can write a potential phi as the sum of a Gaussian random field plus a small quadratic correction FNL phi squared. Okay? Right. This is all I wanted to say. Okay. Right. Now, as usual, so as usual, we can compute the non-Gaussian density from this potential using the Poisson equation, okay? And so applying the Laplacian to this expression, so we can see that the non-Gaussian density has a correction compared to the Gaussian density with these two terms in it. Okay, and so now the important point is that in the neighborhood of very high peaks, this first term will be large compared to this term. Okay, So if we neglect the second term compared to the first term, we can see that the non-Gaussian density is simply related to the original Gaussian density. Let's say small correction, that scales like this number FNL, times the value of the potential at the peak, times the original peak height. Okay? Yeah, okay, right. Yeah. So the effect of non-Gaussianity is to, Well, so the effect is to boost the heights of the peaks by an amount depending upon the local potential at the peak. Okay. I'll skip that. Okay. All right, so here's how this looks in practice, okay? Okay, so here I'm showing you again simulations of cosmologies that have different amounts of non-Gaussianity. The middle panel shows a normal Gaussian simulation, okay, And so the standard kind of, you know, cosmic web features are still apparent here. Okay, right. So we have like void-like regions here, we have like origins regions like here and here. Okay. Now, for positive non-Gaussianity, what happens is that the peaks in the overdense regions get boosted in height. Okay, this makes the overdense regions become more evolved compared to the Gaussian case. Okay, so as you can see, as you can see, the halos forming in the overdense region tend to be bigger than the halos here, right? And there's more of those halos. Whereas in contrast, the underdense region becomes less evolved, okay, compared to the Gaussian case. Okay, so the particle distribution here you can see, still have grid lines present in the particle distribution, just showing the particles haven't moved at all, right? Okay, since the start of the simulation. Mm-hmm. You have a question like them or?
No, I'm squinting for sight purposes.
It didn't come out so well on this compared to my screen. Sorry. I guess the PIs are budget isn't good enough to get. Okay, and of course the opposite sign of FNL produces the opposite sign effect. Okay, so for negative FNL, the void-like region becomes more evolved, the void contrast is deeper as you can see, while the overdense region becomes less evolved, as you can see. Okay? And so for that reason, the halos that actually form in these cosmologies will preferentially form inside of the underdense regions, just because the overdense regions haven't yet evolved. Okay. So for negative non-Gaussianity, you find an overall anti-correlation between the amount of matter in some region and the number of halos in that region. Okay, a very surprising counterintuitive.
So how am I to understand the significance of the size of that scale, 500, 5,000? I mean, the corrections
these are all insanely large.
That's what I thought.
Yes. Yeah, okay, right.
So this is just for illustrative purposes.
It's purely just to illustrate qualitatively the effect that goes on. The actual effect will be much harder even to see than this difference, which is hard to see as it is. But fortunately, using statistics, we can actually pull out the signal. Okay. Okay, good, right. That's this slide. Okay. All right, so now let's try to quantify these effects that we saw pictorially, okay? We can quantify them using statistics like, say, the two-point function, the power spectrum, and so on. Okay. Now, we normally measure the clustering of halos and galaxies using a quantity that we call the bias, right? And so the bias is defined as the derivative of the number of halos or galaxies in some region as the background density level in that region is varied up and down. Okay, so let me show you what I mean. Okay, so suppose that we have some region, like shown here, okay? And suppose that the initial density field has the following sort of peaks and troughs in it, okay? So the high peaks, of course, can collapse to make halos, right? Now, if we boost the background density level by some amount, this boosts the number of peaks above threshold, and thereby boosts the number of halos that actually form. Okay? And so the bias just corresponds to the ratio of this halo excess, okay, divided by the boost that was used to make the halo excess. Okay? That's what it means. Let's skip that. Okay. As we saw in my previous talk, okay, it's possible to predict very precisely this bias for halos and galaxies using that same very simple peaks viewpoint, okay, and that's shown here. Okay, So here I'm showing a comparison of the bias measured in simulations for halos compared to the prediction from that very, well, the prediction from that very simple peaks model that I described before. Okay, and so now I'll try to apply the same peaks model to describe non-Gaussian bias. Okay, so how does bias work when we have non-Gaussianity? Okay, so let's consider the effect of some long wavelength background mode, some long wavelength background density delta, and some background potential phi. Okay? Right. Okay, so the effect of the density delta, of course, is to boost the heights of the peaks just additively by delta. Okay, that's the standard bias effect that we just saw. Okay. Once we have non-Gaussianity, however, there's an extra effect. Okay, so because the heights of the non-Gaussian peaks are related to the potential at the peak, okay, so if we boost the potential at the peak by some amount phi, that boosts the heights of the peaks. Okay, and boosts it by an amount proportional to FNL times phi times the original peak height. And so therefore the total boost in peak height is just the sum of these two terms. Okay. Density term and potential.
Yeah, I'm slightly confused about something. Near in an overdense region, phi is negative.
Ah, very good. Paying attention.
What?
Yeah,
since
very
you
good.
Got the wrong way.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you change signs?
Yeah, that's right. I'm using the opposite sign convention for phi. this is not my choice.
Who made the mistake? Somebody.
I guess Bardeen, right?
Unfortunately, it was a really good guy.
Otherwise, it'd be corrected, right?
So while the same as paper, I think I use the opposite sign.
So phi is Bardeen's potential.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
All right. We'll forget it.
I can carry on. Okay, good, right. Okay, so good, okay. So the total boost in peak height is the sum of these two terms. And so therefore, the total halo excess produced by this boost in peak height is, the boost in the halo excess is just the original Gaussian bias times this total boost in the height of the peaks. Okay? Good. Now, of course, in Fourier space, the potential phi is just proportional to the density delta times some factors coming from the Poisson equation. Okay? Right. So the overall halo excess produced by this background mode is just proportional to the background density delta. Okay, yeah, I can write. And so therefore, by definition, all of this stuff is defined as the non-Gaussian halo bias. Okay, and you can see that the non-Gaussian bias is related to the original Gaussian bias with a correction that's because like FNL, and most importantly, as a 1 over k squared correction and factor, coming from the Poisson equation in Fourier space. Okay, so let me show you how this looks. Okay, so here's how this looks in terms of the power spectrum. Okay, so here I'm plotting the halo mass cross spectrum. Right. Okay, so the middle curve shows a normal Gaussian power spectrum for FNL equals zero. The upper curves show what happens for positive non-Gaussianity. The lower curves show what happens for negative non-Gaussianity. Okay. So the correction from FNL scales like 1 over k squared. So on small scales where k is large, the correction is tiny. Okay? There's no effect on small scales. And on large scales, though, the effect is enormous, as you can see. Okay? So for large negative FNL, okay, the overall sign of the bias can change sign, okay, producing overall anti-correlation between halos and mass on large scales that we saw before in the pictures. Okay, good. Okay, so you can see that on large scales, So you can see that on large scales, FNL produces a huge effect on the power spectrum, and because the effect is so huge, we can now look for this effect actual data. Okay, so now I'll show some of that. Okay, so the idea is to measure the clustering of objects on very, very large scales. Okay, So to probe large scales, you want a survey that covers a lot of the sky and a survey going at the very high redshift, okay, for your volume. And fortunately for us, you know, surveys like this currently are being done. Okay, so one example of this is shown here. So these are the constraints you can derive on non-Gaussianity by looking at the clustering of radio sources in the NDSS catalog. This is work done by Nash and Nash and Andrew here at Catherine Miller. Okay? And so by looking at these sources, they were able to constrain FNL, you know, down to around, like, I guess, like 200 or so. Okay, another example is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Okay. So in a recent paper, Slozar and collaborators analyzed the clustering of photometric quasars in Sloan along with luminous red galaxies. Okay. And they were able to place this amazingly strong constraint on Gaussianity. So let me show you one of their plots. Okay, so here is a plot of the quasar angular power spectrum, the auto spectrum. So large scales correspond to small l. Okay, now you can see that on small l scales, okay, you know, the quasar power is very, very small. Okay, right, yeah, I know. So near zero, in fact, the quasars appear to be consistent with having zero power on large scales. Okay. But as we saw before, non-Gaussianity can produce enormous power on large scales. Okay, so from the absence of So from the absence of any power on large scales in the quasars, Slozar et al. Were able to do they were able to place very strong constraints on FNL, mostly coming from the quasars. So here are their results. Okay. So using Sloan LRGs and quasars, they're able to bound FNL, you know, to around 30 or so, plus or minus like 40 or 50 or 60. Okay, that's already competitive with the bounds you can place using WMAP. Okay, so very exciting. Yeah. All right, so this is what's possible today using old data from Sloan. Okay, I think this is all 95%. This is all 95%. Okay, good. And so now what? And so now what's possible to do in the near future using some of the upcoming data sets? Okay, right. So in the near future, you know, lots and lots of large scale surveys are being planned. Okay, some of these you may have heard of, like, say, LSST or BOSS. Okay, the goal for most of these large scale surveys is to measure the Baran acoustic oscillation feature in the galaxy power spectrum. Okay, But to do that, though, you know, these surveys require also very large volumes. Okay, you know, making them perfect, therefore, also for doing this sort of FNL measurement. Okay, so yeah, okay. So one example of this is shown in this figure. So here I'm showing the error on FNL expected for a survey, you know, a proposed mission called Euclid. Okay, so Euclid is a BAO mission. It's supposed to cover like half the sky, going out to very high redshift. Okay, and for reasonable source densities, Euclid is forecasted to reach FNL down to order unity. Okay, you know, which is just fantastic. That's the guaranteed detection regime. Okay, right. Okay, so yeah. Okay, so yeah. So this is with galaxies. We can also use other objects besides just galaxies. Okay, so one example is shown here. Okay, so a postdoc at Michigan, Carlos Cunha, has been analyzing the forecast expected for FNL using SZ surveys like ACT and SPT, and surprisingly, surprisingly, you know, cluster surveys can also do about as well as galaxy surveys. I was surprised by this result. Okay. It's certainly based on the cluster or clustering. That's right. But the number density of clusters, though, is much less than galaxies. Right. So shot noise, therefore, in your measurement is much higher. And so I'm surprised that it's possible to get comparable error bars using clusters as you could with galaxies.
The thing is, you're selecting galaxies on a very narrow tracer. You're selecting them by QSOs and radio sources,
which may tend to select out similar kinds of objects, high-density objects in high-density regions. So that may be a contributing factor. You're not just randomly selecting galaxies by picking out QSOs.
That's right.
And radio galaxies.
That's right.
And they tend to be in denser environments.
So it's just basically a larger bias. Clusters have more bias.
Yeah, that's right. They have a higher bias.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
but the number density, though, you know, is much, much different.
That's right.
So, yeah, so I'm just somewhat surprised by this. Yeah. It's probably true because, the smart people these days. Okay, so that's exciting because clusters have a much higher mass scale than galaxies. Okay, so clusters have a mass scale, hundreds of thousands of times bigger than galaxies. Okay, and that's important because this large scale bias effect that I've been talking about. That effect is basically measuring FNL on the mass scale of the tracer that you're looking at. Okay? So because you can measure FNL precisely on multiple different mass scales, you can therefore measure FNL and also its scale dependence very precisely. Okay. And Sarah's working on this right now, I hope. you have a BlackBerry. I think I should. Okay, so good. All right. So overall, the forecast for FNL, today looked very, very promising. Okay, it appears very likely that it appears very, very likely that in the near future we can reach FNL down to ordered unity. Okay, which would be amazing. Yes.
Is this an okay time to
interrupt that? So
if the primordial perturbations were perfectly Gaussian, would you still see FNL order? Would you still see scale dependence at a sort of FNL of order one level?
Yes, there are effects that can mimic the scale dependent bias effect. The ISW effect, perturbs the redshifts of objects, right? Okay, and that perturbation looks like this sort of FNL of ordered unity. But because of the equivalence principle, though, that effect will be bias independent. Okay, So I think that you still can pull out this signal from that kind of like foreground signal, using the bias dependence. Yeah.
So in principle, it's not one isn't the limit. It's just kind of a coincidence that surveys at the moment are petering out about one. Like in the future, can you imagine being sensitive to a 10?
Yeah, I'm not sure actually.
That was our prediction. That's just kind of one command is 0.1.
So are there models that go below one?
Yeah.
They go as far down as they want.
Most of them do.
Yeah. Single field inflation
single
typically
field
predicts roughly of order slow ball. So of order n is minus one.
4%.
There are corrections to that, though, right? Yeah. Okay, good. All right. This is the last slide, Okay. So to summarize what I said, so non-Gaussianity is a very sensitive probe. The physics of the very early universe. We can predict the effect, produced by non-Gaussianity on the large scale distribution of like quasars and galaxies and so on, late times. And so observations of this effect have already placed very strong constraints on non-Gaussianity. And in the near future, it appears likely, but it appears likely that the next generation of surveys should reach down to FNL of order unity. Okay, and I will stop there.
So if the future data gets FNL down to 1, right, unless you still start with the problem you started with. Less than 10 to minus 4.
Yeah, however, I wouldn't mention that.
However, the standard lambda CDN cosmology is based on a Bateman, the nature, Robinson, Walker, Packer.
Of course, yeah.
Taken from machine. However, they are now competing in the machinist model. In these models, the age of the universe could be bigger than 13.7. The whole business of growth structure is different.
I see. Mm-hmm. But these models still match observations like
they still are now matching observations, including the WMAP data, which is the aspect of the pattern.
Yeah. That's very interesting, yeah.
But the FLW model is the most symmetric model, probably too simple.
This is all worth thinking about, yeah. Oh, yeah, please.
So like, how many, right now you have exactly one of these freak clusters?
Oh, in our sample. Yeah, right. Let's see, I have, no. let me find that slide. Yeah, okay, right. Yeah. So this is our most massive object by far. So in different surveys, there are sort of, comparably freakish objects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, right. Yeah.
Isn't there a
the massive
cluster?
There's a cluster at redshift 1.4 whose mass is much smaller than this, but it's a much higher redshift, which also boosts the freakiness factor. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah.
Is that similar
in unlikeliness? It is somewhat more likely than this object. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But it's also still a problem.
There was also a cluster which Jim Peebles talked about, I think 10, 15 years ago, that he was basically saying this is
It might have been, So it might have been Ada Bacall's, like Z equals one cluster that she used to rule out omega matter equals one.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. The world was different. The universe was smaller.
Like the pink elephant, is that
the pink elephant? Yeah.
But I'm still wondering how freaky is this. So are you saying this is, this is a one cluster in 10 to the 4 would be this, you would expect to see, or one universe in 10 to the 4 would you expect to see a cluster this
massive? Yeah. The expected number in our, the expected number for our survey area was this number. The expected number across the entire universe, I guess would be like 10 to the minus 2. It's our area covered like a percent.
So that's, it's still a complicated function because you have to fold in your detection function, depending on how you detect your clusters,
is a very conservative estimate we've done here, right? We're counting all halos, right?
How did you detect your clusters? What was your survey?
Yeah, that's right. So the source catalog came from RCS actually here. Yeah, right. And so they have they have a certain, selection criterion.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But that doesn't matter, I think, though, right?
That's not just the craziest number.
Yeah. Adrian.
So,
how big FNL would you need to make this less concerning?
So like 500-ish, which is already...
Already well done. So even FNL is not going to save you at this object.
But maybe if you have, scale-dependent, equilateral biofilms stuff.
That's not ridiculous.
There are many forms of non-Gaussian entity. I'm pretty sure, though...
Local non-Gaussian entity is a set of many zero.
Exactly what we're going to do. But you still have to perturb the fluctuations quite significantly away from Gaussian to make these sort of things, and I think that's just going to be hard.
Well, you said the same thing with cold spot on this one.
Which also turned out not to be anything, so.
Really? I thought people in CETA were Gaussian, and it's worth it.